Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Shabbat Shalom, we are in Genesis chapter 37. Vayeshev, he settled. 37 through Genesis chapter 40. Chapter 40. Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Jacob. Joseph, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph would bring evil reports about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons since he was a child of his old age, and he made him a fine woolen tunic. His brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved most of all his brothers, so they hated him. They could not speak to him peaceably. Joseph dreamt a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear, if you please, this dream which I dreamt. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the middle of the field, and behold, my sheaf rose up and also remained standing. And then behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." His brother said to him, "Would you then reign over us? Would you then dominate us?" They hated him even more because of his dreams, because of his talk. He dreamt another dream and related to his brothers. And he said, "Look, I dreamt another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related to his father and to his brothers. His father scolded him, said, "What is this dream you have dreamt? Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow down to you to the ground?" So his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers are pasturing in Shechem, are they not? Come, I will send you to them." He said to him, "Here I am." He said to him, "Now go, look into the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring me back word." So he sent to him from the depths of Hebron, and he arrived at Shechem. A man discovered him, and behold, he was blundering in the field. The man asked him, "What do you seek?" He said, "My brothers do I seek. Tell me, please, where are they pasturing?" The man said, "They have journeyed on from here, for I heard them saying, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him coming from afar when he had not yet approached them. They conspired against him to kill him. This is one another, "Look, that dreamer's coming. So now, come, let us kill him. Throw him into one of the pits. We'll say a wild beast devoured him, and then we shall see what become of his dreams." Now Reuben heard, and he rescued him from their hand. He said, We will not strike him mortally." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit in the wilderness." But they lay no hand on him, intending to rescue him from their hand, to return him to his father. So it was, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the fine woolen tunic that was upon him. They took him, they cast him into the pit. The pit was empty, no water was in it. They sat to eat food, and they raised their eyes. They saw, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing spices, balsam, and lotus, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What gain will there be if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let our hand not be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." His brothers agreed, and the Midianite men, traders, passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph to Egypt. Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he rent his garments, returned to his brothers, and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where can I go?" They took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a goatling, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They dispatched the fine woolen tunic and they brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Identify, if you please. Is it your son's tunic or not?" He recognized it and said, "My son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to bits." Then Jacob rent his garments and placed sackcloth on his loins. He mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to comfort himself and said, "For I will go down to the grave mourning before my son." And his father bewailed him. Now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, a courtier of the Pharaoh, the chamberlain of the butchers. 238. It was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards an Adullamite man, whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a prominent Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He married her and consorted with her. She conceived and bore a son. He called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And yet again she bore a son, and called his name Shelah. It was in Chesed when she bore him. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar, but Judah's firstborn was evil in the eyes of the Lord. The Lord caused him to die. Then Judah said to Onan, "Consort with your brother's wife. Enter in levirate marriage with her and establish offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the seed would not be his, so it was that whenever he would consort with his brother's wife, he would let it go to waste on the ground so as not to provide offspring for his brother. What he did was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and he caused him to die also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "Lest he also die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Many days passed, and Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When Judah was consoled, he went up to oversee the shapeshearers, he and his Adullamite friend, Hira, to Timnah. So I was told as follows, "Behold, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garb from upon her, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself up. Then she sat by the crossroads on the road toward Timnah. She saw that Shelah had grown, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, since she had covered her face. So he detoured to her by the road and said, "Come, if you please, let me consort with you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me if you consort with me?" "But I will send you a kid of the goats to the flock." She said, "Provided you leave a pledge until you send it." And he asked, "What pledge shall I give you?" "She said, your signet, your wrap, your staff in your hand." He gave them to her, and he consorted with her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose, left, and removed her veil from upon her, and she put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid of the goats through his friend, the Adullamite, to retrieve the pledge from the woman, but he did not find her. He inquired of the people of the place, saying, "Where is the prostitute, the one at the crossroads by the road?" Said, "There was no prostitute here." He returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her. Even the local men said there was no prostitute here." So Judah said, "Let her keep them, at least become a laughingstock. I already sent her this kid, but you could not find her." It was about 3 months had passed that Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed a harlotry, and moreover, she is conceived by harlotry. You should take her out and let her be burned." As she was taken out, she sent word to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child," she said. "Identify, if you please, whose are these signet, this wrap, and this staff?" Judah recognized them and said, "She is right. It is from me, inasmuch as I did not give her to Shelah, my son." And he was not intimate with her any more. It came to pass at the time that she gave birth, and behold, there were twins in her womb. It happened that as she gave birth, one put out a hand The midwife took a crimson thread and tied it on his hand, saying, "This one emerged first." And it was, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother emerged. And she said, "With what strength you asserted yourself." She called his name Perez. Afterwards, his brother, on whose hand was a crimson thread, came out. And he called his name Zerah. Chapter 39. And Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. Potiphar, a courtier of the Pharaoh, the chamberlain of the butchers, a prominent Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. He remained in the house of his Egyptian master. His master perceived that the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made successful in his hand. Joseph found favor in his eyes, and he attended him. He appointed him over his household, and whatever he had, he placed in his custody. It happened that from that time, he appointed him in his household over whatever he had. The Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on Joseph's account. The blessing was in whatever he owned in the house and in the field. He left all that he had in Joseph's custody, and with him present, he concerned himself with nothing except the bread he ate. Now Joseph was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. At these things, his master's wife cast her eyes upon him. She said, "Lie with me." But he adamantly refused. He said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master concerned himself about nothing in the house, and whatever he has placed in my custody. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has denied me nothing but you, since you are his wife. How then can I perpetrate this great evil and have sinned against God?" So it was. Just as she coaxed Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her and to lie beside her to be with her. Then there was an opportune day when he entered the house to his work, no man of the household staff being there in the house. Then she caught hold of him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." He left his garment in her hand. He fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called out to the men of her household and spoke to them, saying, "Look, he brought this Hebrew man to sport with us. He came to lie with me, but I called out with a loud scream. And when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me, fled and went outside." She kept his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she told him a similar account, saying, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came to sport with me. But it happened that when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and ran outside." It was when his master heard his wife's words, which he spoke to him, saying, "Your slave did things like these to me," his anger flared up. Joseph's master took him and placed him in the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he remained there in prison. The Lord was with Joseph, and he endowed him with great charisma, and he put favor in his eyes the prison warden. The prison warden placed all inmates of the prison in Joseph's custody, and everything that was done there he would accomplish. The prison warden did not scrutinize anything that was in his charge, inasmuch as the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made successful. Chapter 40. Now it happened of these things, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and the baker transgressed against their master, against the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was enraged at his two courtiers, the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers. He placed them in the ward of the house, the chamberlain of butchers, into prison, the place where Joseph was confined. The chamberlain of the butchers appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them, and they remained in the ward for a period of days. The two of them dreamt a dream. Each one had his dream on the same night, each one according to the interpretation of his dream. The cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in prison. Joseph came to him in the morning. He saw them. Behold, they were grieved. He asked Pharaoh's courtiers, who were with him in the ward of his master's house, saying, "Why do you appear downcast today?" They said to him, "We have dreamt a dream, but there's no one to interpret it." Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Relate it to me, if you please." The chamberlain of the cupbearers recounted his dream to Joseph and said, "In my dream, behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. On the grapevine were three tendrils. It was as though it budded, its blossoms bloomed, its clusters ripened into grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation. The three tendrils are 3 days. Then in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your post. And you will place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as was the former practice when you were his cupbearer. If only you would think of me with yourself when he benefits you, and you will do me kindness, if you please, and mention me to Pharaoh, then you would take me out of this building. For indeed, I was kidnapped amongst the land, the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing than to have put me in this pit." The chamberlain of the bakers saw that he had interpreted well, so he said to Joseph, "I too, in my dream, behold, 3 wicker baskets were on my head. In the uppermost basket there were all kinds of Pharaoh's foods, of baker's handiwork, and birds were eating them from the basket from above my head." Joseph responded to him and said, "This is his interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head up from you and hang you on a tree. In other words, he'll eat your flesh from you." And it was on the 3rd day, Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all of his servants, and he counted the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers among his servants. He restored the chamberlain of the cupbearers to his cupbearing, and he placed the cup onto Pharaoh's palm. But he hanged the chamberlain of the bakers. He hung just as Joseph had interpreted the dream. Yet the chamberlain of the cupbearers did not remember Joseph, but he forgot him. That's our Torah portion for today, Genesis 37 through chapter 40.
I have a question.
What is your question, dear?
Okay, we're learning about Joseph. So why is 38 there, chapter 38?
The
it doesn't make sense.
That's a great question. People ask that question for thousands of years. Here's a flow story. Oh, brief interlude. Let's talk about Judah for a minute, and let's go back again. As if it's just the continuous story was interrupted. We're going to discuss that a little bit, hopefully today. Not that it was an interruption, but the fact of what Judah was going through. That Judah and Joseph have a similar type of experience. Mind you, these two men are going to, their descendants, be the dominant tribes of Israel. They will control everything. These two men, their children will. And so when you're studying about where their children come from and how they got where they are, their mental state of being is reflected in their patriarch. So the tribe of Judah's mental state, its existence, how it sees itself, is reflected in the man, Judah. How Ephraim sees itself is reflected in the man, Joseph. So when you're studying these men and their stories, mind you, it doesn't tell you much about Gad or Naphtali or anybody else. They're pretty much ignored as if they're unimportant, because reality is they are unimportant. The state, the future generations for thousands of years are based on what these two men are doing here now, what Judah and Joseph, what they're doing. And these are simultaneous events. So Judah's event and Joseph are going, their parallel stories are happening at the exact same time, over near the exact same time period, the same number of years.
So,
the twin babies. They're all part, because Joseph is in prison for a number of years. And all this process is a sequence of both men's parallel lives, to what they're doing and how they're living their lives. And we can contrast and compare them, because they're both doing it at the exact same time, each other, having no knowledge what the two men are doing. They don't know of each other anymore. As far as Judah is concerned, Joseph's a slave, or if not dead. As far as Joseph is concerned, Judah's back in great standing with his family, which he wasn't. Yes, Daniel.
So, this might be an odd question, but do you think that the early oral storytellers edited out the other sons as unimportant to the story?
No, good question. I really don't know how they did it. I know that during the times of the judges, when most of these stories were being written down, because most of the storytellers were around the time of Joshua and the judges that followed them, and the storytellers would tell of their tribes' history of where they came from, what happened. They would sing their songs. Each tribe had their own songs. That's why you run across the book of Judges, periodically you run across them singing a song. And it's a song that somebody wrote down. But there are lots and lots of songs. And so it was the Levites' job during the time of Judges to go about the countryside and record down history. That was their job. That was their function, to write it down and then preserve the information. And so we got our Bibles, as those men writing down what all the various families taught about their history, where they came from, those details. Else we would have none of this. It'd be all gone. So what I would say is that whether they edited it out, I couldn't say. However, when the Levites were in charge in doing this, who were the dominant tribes of their day? Judah and Ephraim. So when they go to find stories, who they go to? The heads of the various towns, which were of Judah and of Ephraim. They're going to collect those stories because they're the dominant ones in charge. The minor ones were so mixed up with the local Canaanites, you really know whether you were Israelite or not because you couldn't prove it. I think that's probably a bigger factor on who was around to tell the story. Hence, that's the story that's written down for us. Yes.
No matter what, Joseph was an upstanding man, and yes. No matter what, Judah was not upstanding.
Yeah, they had their contrasting opinions of each other. In certain circles, when you do a Torah portion, Judah's conversation, what happens in this chapter 38, is frequently not read, because it's humiliating. Yes.
What's the whole thing with Judah wanting to burn prostitutes when he hired one?
Good question. That's a great question. Let's see here. Marker. Where's your marker? Here's one. So, in Canaan, which is where all this is taking place, Canaanites, they have a certain religious and a certain way of life. So, Canaan. Oops. That's an N. They have multiple gods of all different flavors. Each time of the year, they have a new god they worship and praise. There's the most common ones, Baal. There's Adon. There's Asherah. Let's see, who else they worship? Molech. No, they're all their own individual sub-gods. Their own rules. It's much like, depending on which... Baal is a generic term. I should be more careful. So it's a generic term meaning a lord. So each city had its own specific Baal that it would worship. The Baal of Jericho was different than the Baal of Jerusalem, which was different than the Baal of Sidon, or different than the Baal of Tyre. They all had their own specific gods. Now, depending on who you are, most Canaanites were a mixture of people, but other strangers, like, for example, Amorites, you also have Hittite. All the various, I forget all their names. Hittite. Parasites. Parasites. Then later on, of course, the Philistines show up. A lot of different gods, a lot of different cultures. So it's depending on who ruled that town, dictated what Baal that was to that town. So if you had a Canaanite city, let's use the Canaanite city of, example, Harosheth. Harosheth is the city, the story of Sisera, Deborah, and Barak. The story of Harosheth, when it was under Canaanite control, it typically had, while they were being worshipped during a time when Sisera was around, of course, their gods in that particular town, they worshipped Asherah, Baal, Adon, and Moloch, but at different times of the year. Depending on which time it was, depending on which one was being worshipped. Adon, he was worshipped in the springtime. Baal was worshipped at all the time because he was just a generic lord that was in charge. Ash was worshipped during, which is where our story takes place, during Easter and during weddings. Yes, Easter and weddings. That was her main thing. And Moloch, the god of wrath, was done for child sacrifice, done usually once every year, or every couple of years. You burn a prominent child alive. In order to avoid the wrath coming upon your particular city or town. So Hereshet worshipped all these until Deborah came along and Barak came along and burned it to the ground. And it became a wasteland. But in that particular town, Tyre doesn't say did the same thing, so did Sidon. All the four gods were worshipped. Our story of Tamar, she is supposedly, it doesn't say for certain, a Canaanite most likely. Because we don't have any Canaanites. Tamar is probably a Canaanite. We don't have any record of her history, of who she came from, who her parents were, nothing of that sort. But Judah, his wife, the daughter of Shua, was a Canaanite, because Shua was a Canaanite too. So in their culture, they'd worship all these various gods different times of the year. This is where Tamar's harlotry shows up, in the worship process of Asherah. In Asherah worship, there are a number of times which you would obey this process if you were a female Canaanite. So, when you are betrothed just before your wedding for a week, you are to practice harlotry at the temple of Asherah to any preferably unknown male. So you couldn't be like somebody who you knew who it was, have you strangers, only visitors to the gates. So they typically have their harlots at the gates because their wedding would be in about a week from there, and after that point they would marry whoever they were supposed to marry. And that's a process of Asherah worship. We call the Greeks renamed her, not renamed, sorry, used another name for her called Aphrodite or Aphrodite. Remember that name? And Aphrodite, that goddess. Same process, same worship, same sequence. So, harlotry, religious harlotry is what the women were used for, and that was its function. It's a worship of Asherah, the goddess, the mother god. Asherah is the one who gave birth to Adon, and Baal was supposed to be her husband. Later on, they rewrote it to where Asherah was the wife of Adon, her son. It's really sick. It's a gross process. But, so when Judah comes along, he assumes she's a Canaanite. She's next to or near the town, which where the religious prostitutes would live. He assumes she's an Asherah worshiper. She would probably get married soon to whoever she was married, and she had to be a stranger to him. You couldn't have consort relations with somebody who you knew during this week. You had to be only with strangers. And so he just assumed this is just who she is. Oh, okay, it's just she doesn't care. It's part of her religious belief. Sure, he doesn't care. He's just using her. So that's how the process is pretty typical. Each of the cultures did it at different times. Well, not so much the Hittites. They were kind of, they were a little different. Hittites were not Moloch worshippers. They didn't believe in that. But the rest of them did. The rest of them were Moloch worshippers. And the rest of them had their similar practices. So this is not unusual for what Judah would run across in chapter 38, when he comes across these people showing up and this woman hanging out there as a prostitute. He just assumes, oh, that's her job. That's her business. Because she'll be married soon, as far as he's concerned. Contrast that. Oh, yes, go ahead.
The three things that she gives to Judah, that she asks of Judah. One says a cord, I heard that a cord may have been actually a robe of many colors, like Joseph had.
It's an identifying mark, right? It could be a sash. It could be something that it wears for his family title. We have in European culture, we call it a coat or an arms, an identifying mark. A seal that identifies this is what you are, or your banner that identifies your family name. That's an identifying mark. So makes sense. He is a similar one for each of the tribes had their own. Yes.
So he burned her for practicing pagan ritual.
Right. Okay. Because she was already married. So you do this before the lady gets married. After she's married, somebody doing this process with her pagan culture, she's supposed to be a married woman. You can't do that anymore. And so he killed her. And in Canaanite law, she would be killed too. Both Israelite and Canaanite law. Because she's married now. Oh, she's a widow. Same difference, as far as they're concerned. The one time they agreed. Yeah, Canaanites and Israelites didn't agree on most things. Well, they had to corrupt one another to make them agree. That's pretty gross. It makes sense. Any other question, comments so far about this topic? Yes, Louise.
The older I get and the more I read and the more I comprehend, et cetera, I start to understand how vicious the Roman Empire was, how awful the civilization in Egypt was. And I was thinking about how difficult it was for Jesus to have a foothold only because of God. Then I compare that with us nowadays, how difficult it is for us to be Christians only by the grace of God.
There's a, I won't get into the story details today, but when we look at Messiah's life and the timing of when he showed up was really important, which in the story of Joseph, we have pictures of Messiah, which we'll talk about that today. As far as the storyline Joseph goes through in this part of his life, he's mapping out various parts of Messiah's life too, when Messiah's living. But timing is really, really critical. If Messiah had shown up during a culture which is described here in Genesis, it would have failed miserably. It would not have succeeded. Because the general people, the ordinary citizens, have no comprehension of what God is. His name, nothing. There's no understanding. If he had shown up during the king's time, the people were so corrupt, saying, are you sure that's a God? Or is this over here a God? You're just another prophet who's worshiping or telling us to worship your God, but the guy over here tells us to worship this God. Why would I listen to you? The timing is really important. He had to show up at a time which the general people, the ordinary citizens, didn't have to worry about whether there is a real God, which one's the right God. They already had a general idea. They know who God is. They know who they believe and what they believe. That's when he could show up and say, now we're going to teach you. Now we're going to discuss what life is, what God intended. It took a long time to travel from this worship of pagan gods all the way until the Pharisees and Sadducees are in charge telling people that's not quite what God wanted it done. There's a huge difference. It'll take many, many generations to get there from one to the other. So God's timing, Messiah's timing, had to be just perfect to make it work right. Else it would have failed. It wouldn't have worked. Because we wouldn't have believed it. Wouldn't know how. Wouldn't even care. Any questions or comments? Okay. Yes, go ahead.
I've also heard that despite the fact that the Romans were really nasty, they also allowed people to use their own religion. And the fact that, the fact that they had paved big, long roads everywhere was what Apostle Paul used to be able to get the message out. So that was another part of the
timing. A good part of the timing. Because otherwise it would take him far longer to accomplish what he was doing. And he may have died before he got there because he'd been too old. timing was just perfect to make it work. Yes, good comes out of evil. Which is why we get our story today. I was talking about children last night about how Jacob treats Joseph and how would that make you feel if you were the siblings and seeing Dad was always this guy because he did. There's no real reason. It makes you pretty mad at both the boy as well as your father. I guess I'll use myself as an example. But about me as well as the other child. So their relationship, it was bad. What they were doing wasn't positive. It was causing animosity, causing anger. But through those negative things, God used them to bring about a salvation through Egypt and get everybody alive and everybody survived. So God used a lot of negative things and turned them and used them, putting them together, create something that is perfect. It's why he uses to serve him, else we have even hot water.
Did you say that Judah and Joseph have like a corresponding type of life, you know, where Joseph was in prison? Well, where was Judah's imprisonment except emotionally about what he did with his father?
Judah's imprisonment wasn't a physical one in the way that Joseph's was. It was still physical, but Joseph was then actually behind bars, right? Cage, locked, you can't get out, that kind of thing. Judah's imprisonment was isolation. Isolated from his family. And we'll discuss that a little bit today as far as the type of isolation he went through, which is not worse, it's not better either, it's just different than what Joseph went through. Alright, let's jump through this. Vayeshev settled. The settlement means settled. Jacob settled. So he settled in this area where his father sojourned. Of course, the land of Canaan, obviously in Hebron. And I'll get the map in a minute. But we'll leave this up for a second. So Joseph, obviously the youngest, he's about 17 years old, as it lists here. In verse 2, Joseph, he's the youth, he's a youth amongst the children. He's sent to chapter 37, verse 2. Sorry, go back to the beginning of our Torah portion. 37, verse 2. The sons of two daughters, Bilhah and Zilpah. And which sons did those two ladies have? Remember? Which sons were they? No, not firstborns. Leah's was the firstborn. Reuben was the firstborn. And then she had, I forgot the exact order. I think Simeon, the Levite, and Judah. I think it was that order. Those first three, first four kids. But she had like seven or eight total. So there was Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. These are the four sons. So Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Asher is a fortune, or a pleasant. That's a pleasant. His name means pleasant. So in Joseph, he was sent to these four sons. And what did he do? And let's hear. He gave them a bad report to their father, evil report to their father. He did not go to Leah's kids. Write her name correctly. Which she had all the other children. There's Reuben. There's Judah. Levi. Simeon. Zebulun. I forgot all the names. What's that? Issachar, that's right. I never pronounce it right. Zebulun. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's right. Six boys, right? Oh, Dinah's the daughter, right? The seventh was the daughter. I will list her there. She's probably not shepherding the flock. See, he was sent to these four, but not these other six sons. That implies that the father's flocks were probably big enough to where he divided them up into different regions. If you remember back when Abraham and Lot were together, back in early part of Genesis, what was the reason for their separation? Too many flocks, which stuff. They couldn't stay together. So they separated and divided up the direction which they went. They didn't go very far from each other. Yes? Did I get this mixed up? Which one? Gad and Asher. Did I get it mixed up on which one was which? I may have. Well, by memory, not by writing it down. Anyway. Yes, the servants' kids. So, which one's which then? Which one of these go? Gad and Asher, or Dan? It wasn't Dan, because Dan I know is. Yeah, check. I'm getting the right names right. I was going by memory when I wrote it down, which one was which. I may have written down wrong. Anyhow, so he sends to one group and not the other group. The whole point is we understand that their larger flocks get divided up. I'm not going to say one's sheep and one's goats, but the point is they were divided out and separated out for their purpose or their reasons. When, however, he comes to his brothers at Dothan, who's there? Reuben's there. Judah's there. Now, Simeon's there. So they have Leah's children are there. So we learn, at least from this example, when he's 17 years old, these four boys were probably not at the same location as the other six. So which one did he go to when he gets thrown in the pit? The other six. These four boys and their descendants probably were not there at that time. Probably. Not saying for certain, but probably. There's Leah's kids, which would sort of make sense. Look back at how Jacob treated Leah and Rachel. Did Leah's kids, her sons, realize that he loved Rachel more? Yes, that was pretty obvious. So they already know and they already had animosity toward any descendant of Rachel because of how he treated Leah and her children. So they already had this to start with, and the two daughters, Leah and Rachel, also fought and argued over the same topic. They got the whole, you stole my husband already, going back and forth, discussing this topic we discussed in Genesis. So we already have animosity built between both women, and of course, their sons will just carry on that process. Of course, how it's continuing on. It is a dysfunctional family, that is true. But they hated and they couldn't speak peaceably to him. So even if these four boys were not there, they still didn't like him because they still knew that Jacob liked this son better than they liked them. Now, where's Benjamin, meanwhile? He's at home with the dad. Does Jacob like Benjamin? Most likely, yes. But Benjamin's a little boy still. But Joseph, of course, is the one who they see and can interact with during this time. They were correct? So it was Zebulun over here? And Issachar. That's all right. My memory's not perfect, so I make mistakes. I was going by memory of who went where. Okay, so the names were corrected. So it is Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher is Bilhah and Zilpah, and then Reuben, Levi, Judah, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar are as Leah. Let's see here. Where was I? Okay, so what got him in the pit? What's that? Yeah, 17 years old. He divided, so these boys are probably separated out. They probably aren't hanging out together. Because he had sent off to go visit, to go see, and Jacob's asking to go check out the other boys. To see how things are going with them. Because mind you, when you send your flocks out, it's not there, not for a day, but for weeks or months. You may not hear back for a long period of time, depending on where the pasture is, where the shepherd takes them. You get that they can be brought back during shearing time, during birthing time. So usually in the spring, we're brought back for the spring, because most of the sheep and goat give birth in the spring. And you're back for shearing, for the shearing of the sheep. Other than that, they're out in the fields. Yeah, they live with the sheep, live in the fields. The shepherds are not, they live in tents, they wander with their flocks. Pretty typical. Yeah. Yeah, because wolves and such are out at what time of day? Wolves. They're usually out at nighttime. Coyotes. Lions, probably in the day too, but lions see good at night too. So, they're out there eating when there's an opportunity, so a shepherd has to be there at all times to fight back. Okay, so he winds up going to these boys when he gets thrown in the pit. Before we get there, let's discuss the dreams he had. So he has two dreams. The first dream, of course, he relays to his brothers, not his dad. What does the dream show? Remember? What was it? How many sheaves were there? 11 sheaves, which means... Judah's the one... Joseph's the one being worshipped, being bowed down to. That means Benjamin is bowing down too. Even his younger brothers has bowed down as well. So including Benjamin too. So it'd be over his brother Benjamin, which makes sense. He's the firstborn of the family now that Reuben blew it earlier on. His brothers, of course, get upset. So you reign over us. Now, who is interpreting the dream? The brothers are. It's important to note that. Because as Joseph points out to the cupbearer and the baker, what does he say to them? Do not interpretations belong to God? So when somebody else interprets the dream, either they're interpreting on God's behalf or they're interpreting on their own behalf. So in this case, when it comes to dreams, now mind you, who else is a dreamer in his family? Jacob himself was a dreamer, right? So dreams, interpretation... I have to spell it right. Interpret, they belong to God. So is dream like a vision? Someone who sees visions. As opposed to the other term referred to prophet and known as a seer. Someone who sees things. Now, don't get me wrong. A prophet can have a dream too. But a dream, one who just dreams, gives messages through dreams only. Like Joseph with Mary is a good example. In the case of a seer, a prophet or prophetess, they will get dreams or audio messages through awake events or from hearing events. So that's a different. I don't know. God hasn't done it to me, so I can't tell who else God speaks to. But he doesn't speak to me through that. So we get the example of Elijah and Elisha and such. When they're awake, they receive visions and dreams. They're awake and they can see angels doing stuff. They're, They are not just a dreamer, they are a seer too. They are a prophet too. Because they can, God give messages whether awake or asleep, makes a difference. In the case of Joseph and the case of Jacob, when did they get dreams? When they were asleep. They were all boys, they were always asleep. So their dreams are for sleeping time. Not the same as the other prophets, which are seers. They have a slightly different word. It's subtle, I know that. But it's still a subtly different word. But dreamers are a little different group of those than the seers, as far as the prophets are concerned. And that would be a prophet, because he was still awake. If he's still awake, then he is a prophet or a seer, as opposed to... That's different. You're just a dream. It's just a dream then. The purpose of the example of the, like I said, the words are very, very subtle. The intent is that one is you dream it, you wake up, okay, what was my dream? What did it mean? You write it all down, you try to ask God, what's the interpretation? And the other is, you maybe some form of dream is too, but you can be awake and you see something and you realize, my eyes have been opened, I now see something.
Yeah. See it in the spirit.
Exactly. You are wide awake when you're doing it, typically. That we classify as prophets. So Elijah, Elisha, those men were wide awake when they got their visions, and when they saw stuff, they knew what was, and they could talk to it. They could interact with it. Most of us don't do that in our dreams, per se. Well, not try. We try, but it doesn't work so well. Anyway, dreams belong to God. Interpreting. In this case, for his two dreams, who interpreted? So his brothers, they interpret the sheaves as being themselves, which is not right or wrong, just is. But it came to the stars and the moon and the sun. Who interpreted that dream? But Jacob did. So Jacob interpreted dreams. So brother interpreted the sheaves, and Jacob interpreted the stars. Yes. What was that?
Ancient news reporters.
So both Jacob and his brothers are using or putting themselves in place of God temporarily to interpret a dream. Are they right or wrong? Well, they turned out their dreams were right, so whether they interpreted it right or wrong makes a difference. It turned out that's how they interpreted it. The interpretation was correct. That's exactly what had happened. But the interpretation is the idea of the interpretation belonged to God. Most dreams, of course, are just randomized thoughts. We don't really think about it, don't care about them. But every once in a while you get a dream or an image or a message from God, the interpretation must be from God, not from yourself. Not from your best friend who said, oh, I want it to say this. I want it to mean that. No, interpretations are important. Don't mix them up with our own interpretations upon a dream that God didn't give you the answer. Don't assert your interpretation upon it as if what you're saying is true or putting yourself as a prophet. Because no offense to anybody else in the room, I'm not one. I don't know of any. I've never met someone who can interpret dreams correctly. So it's wise to not go there. Yes.
Okay, so I just heard a teaching. I'll just leave his name blank. Sorry. But he was saying this morning that that when Joseph told his first dream, he was very young. He was 17. And then, you know, and by the time he was imprisoned, he had matured more. And so when he was speaking to the butler and the
cupbearer,
he was... more cautious, and by then I'm sure that he spiritually discerned things like she'd said, that, you know, like when Christ came, he said, you know, how can I tell you of heavenly things when you don't understand earthly things? There's things that we in our spirit know, and we know that we know, but we don't know how we know. There's just a sense. And so I think God gives us that discernment, and we develop it as we mature. Like Louise said, as she was a young girl, she thought like this. Remember, she said, when you were young, by the time Peter said, oh, I'll take you around.
You understand more.
Someone will put you in diapers and take you where you don't want to go.
Yeah, I just
was thinking, you know, he matured like we do.
We do.
And then
that's
we learned to know who Christ is.
And in many ways, yes. As you
like
grow and as you experience, mind you, Joseph starts interpreting the dreams, telling people, he still interprets them. After he's already been at the benefit recipient of all of God's blessings for over and over and over again. So Joseph, he has a very good understanding and relationship with God. God's blessing everything he does. And so he's growing in his understanding about what God wants of him. So he's a very smart man. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying his interpretations are wrong, because obviously all of them were correct. But we as people, be aware of what you interpret dreams about. Yes.
There's two things.
by them interpreting those dreams, they were actually wrong in doing that. Is that correct? That's what you're saying.
Unwise. Unwise.
Right. Whether they were right about the dream or not, it was something they really shouldn't
have done. It's unwise, yeah.
But now, if God gives the dream to the dreamer, and God also responds in a way that that person would understand the interpretation of that dream. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The dreams here that the boys and Jacob interpreted were not, you know, impossible to figure out. They're pretty obvious. You got 11 sheaves and one. How many brothers he had? He had 11 brothers. It's pretty obvious what the interpretation actually is. But yeah, just be aware of where we be careful when we start interpreting dreams. And also the stars, the moon, and the sun. Again, there are 11 stars. There's a dad. There's a mom. The interpretation is relatively obvious too. But still, it's unwise. It's unwise. Let's continue on, because this is more interesting stuff. Let's see here. So he has multiple dreams. Obviously, get upset and yada yada yada. What's his father do? He chastises him. He says, "You're why is he chastising him? Why? What does it matter?" Yeah. The interpretation of the stars and such and the moon was that Jacob and the mom, now mind you, I'm using the term mom as opposed to Rachel because Rachel's dead. I don't know if he's referring to mom, referring to biological mother or my current wife because he still has other wives. I don't know what Jacob is referring to, so I can't answer it correctly. My interpretation, my personal opinion is probably Rachel, but I just can't swear to it. I don't know. And his brothers would be lower than Joseph.
Yeah.
Hence, chastising. Do you ever treat or consider or act as if your parents are lower than you? Better not. You're not supposed to. Your parents are the ones who raise you. That's to honor your mother and father, right? One of the Ten Commandments, that's a big one. That's a whole, you don't do it, you know, bad things happen to you. It's a big deal. You honor your parents, you honor your mother and father. That does not mean treat them lower than you. But the opposite. You are to treat them higher than you. So his chastisement was the fact that in the interpretation, he is putting Jacob as if Jacob and the mom are lower than Joseph. Now, does it actually happen that way? Yes. So is it correct? Interpretation correct? Yes. Is Joseph at fault for it? No. It happens exactly the way it's supposed to happen, exactly the way it was designed for. But the idea of doing it is reprehensible to a parent in particular. But what's Jacob then do? He keeps it in mind. He knows, okay, something is about this. Something's true about this. I don't like it. Something's true about this. I have to understand. I'll try to understand or comprehend it later. Think keeping it in mind. So, of course, Jacob gets the opportunity to understand that, obviously, later on in Genesis when he bows to Pharaoh and he is under the control or the ownership of management of Joseph himself and Joseph's household. There is metaphorical interpretations too to the stars as well as the moon and the sun. I'm going to talk about them just briefly before I move on to a different topic. Say again? There's a metaphor built into this. Oh, sheaves. Oh, the word sheaves. I apologize. So you have sun, moon, and stars. In your Bibles, when these topics start showing up, these mean certain things. These not worshiping, I don't worship sun, worship stars, but they mean things. Yes, Carrie.
It looks like maybe you're going the same way my mind did, but I was only going to say that, yes, only God should be the interpreter, but also I think that he gives us patterns to follow. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting. I was watching a video this week about how Pharaoh didn't understand this stuff. But interestingly enough, Joseph's brothers did understand this stuff because they were correct in their interpretation.
Right,
so
right.
Obviously God speaks to his people mm-hmm. in a specific code.
Yeah. so that they
understand things
differently, better, or more greater understanding. Because you're right, Pharaoh could not understand his dreams. The cupbearer, the baker, could not understand their dreams. But all of Joseph's brothers understood Joseph's dreams. Jacob understood Joseph's dreams. They all understood his dreams. So the whole family could interpret dreams reasonably well, while nobody else seemed to figure it out, though the other people may have been smarter. I don't know the reasons why, but they just didn't understand it. Most likely, they didn't understand the idea of how God thinks and talks. So regards sun, moon, stars, and these particular events, there's obviously the physical one that Jacob interpreted. Stars, your brothers, the sun's me, the moon's your mom. Obvious. Mind you, Joseph is acting out a Messiah in this role. He is playing Messiah. So, replace Jacob, replace the mother, replace the star, or the brothers, with what bows down to Messiah? What would represent the sun to Messiah? What would represent the moon to Messiah? What would represent the stars to Messiah? He is a messianic figure. Jacob is one of the most prominent messianic figures in the entire Bible, one of. And this is his main part of his story, starting here. So he's playing out Messiah's life. So these three symbols have a Messiah-based understanding, a metaphor or a spiritual knowledge of what they mean. To understand what these symbols are, Messiah has to have the sun bow down to him. I mean, he's in charge of. The moon bows down to him. He's in charge of. The stars bow down to him. He's in charge of. What bows down to him? Everything bows. What does the Torah say the sun is? What's the Torah tell you the sun is? What does it mean? No, not God. No, that's a pagan philosophy. What does the Torah say the sun is? It's what you're doing today. It defines day. It defines days as far as how days come and days go. It rules the day. It's for counting on a weekly basis, a Shabbat. We decide when Shabbat is based on the sun coming up, the sun going down. Is it based on the moon? No. Is it based on the stars? No. The sun controls when every 7 days happen. Day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's given us in Genesis chapter 1. The sun's job is to determine when Shabbat is, the seventh day of rest, when God rested from creation. So the sun's job is to determine days and Shabbat. What does the Torah tell us the moon's job is? Say it a little louder. I didn't hear you.
Months.
And what else is for months? Seasons, because it tells you what day of the month you do this, what day of the month you do that, which month it happens to be for the fifth holy day versus that holy day, the 15th day of the month, or the first day of the seventh month. The moon decides holy day times. So the moon is appointments. And holy days in particular. So far, with the sun and the moon, we understand that as a messianic symbol, the Shabbat will bow down to Messiah. He is the Lord of the Sabbath. You ever heard that term before?
Yeah.
Where'd you hear that from? The New Testament Bible. Yeah, he's the Lord of the Sabbath. Messiah himself said so. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. So the sun bows down to him too. The moon, the appointments, the holy days. Is he in charge of those? Have you ever heard the term Passover? Yeah. What does that symbolize? What is the symbol? What's the main character, main thing in Passover? What is it? It's a lamb. It's a Passover lamb. And what is he? He is the Passover lamb, right? So he controls Passover. He's also the first of the grave. What holy day is that? First fruits. He controls that too. So he also... Oh, I'm sorry. I'll use the example. These are just examples. So the moon, the appointment time, he's in charge of all of them. He controls every one of them. He decides what the symbol is, the timing, the whole course. So he's appointed to that. That bows down to him. What are the stars? The people. The individual people. If you look through your Bibles and start looking at, all right, when does God say, I will number you like the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens? Abraham did it, Moses did it, Daniel did it. He repeated himself over and over and over again. Ezekiel did it 4 or 5 times. He said, they will be the stars of heaven. stars in heaven, if you can count them. Is he referring to every schmuck and every Harry that ever was?
No.
Certain people who desire, not the lowly ones who want to say, God, forget you, I'm going to go enjoy and worship Molech, for example. It's those who are choosing to follow God amongst all the descendants. So the stars, the interpretation Jacob gave was correct, his brothers, but the certain grouping of his brothers, brothers that obey or are associated with the moon and the sun. So they're associated with the Shabbat, they're associated with the holy days, the appointment times, their light shines. Have you seen a star? Yeah, it shines. What is it? It's a light. So the star's light shines. A light shining is a person. A person, and it, Daniel says explicitly in chapter 11, the stars equal the saints, the followers of God. It says so. That's what it is. So Daniel tells you, the stars, the people, or the brothers in particular, but the descendants. So I'll list here the children who are following, the same sun, the moon, the same pattern of the Shabbats and the holy days. So he's in charge, he's master of all of them. All of them will bow down to Messiah or bow down to Joseph in this example, what we're discussing. So the interpretation is both a physical one when it comes to, obviously, Jacob, his mom, and the brothers, but also the spiritual one referring to the Lord of the Sabbath, the Lord of the appointment times, the Lord of all the children of God. So all of them will bow down to him. That's the idea. He's in charge of all of them. I won't go into the other pagan beliefs about the sun being the creator God and such. That's a different Mother Earth stuff. I won't go there. Because that's not part of the Torah's a viewpoint or how they see history, or how they see the world. Let's see here. Let's see. I'm going to erase this other side because I have other things to write down. Now, I mentioned earlier that Joseph is playing a messianic role. He's playing an example of Messiah. And we've talked about this year on end as far as these various topics. But again, when it comes to our portions, certain things you have to talk about because they're important, they matter. I'm going to list every single example because there's a lot of them. I'll give the general idea of an imagery to understand how Joseph is examining or playing the Messiah in his life at just this part of the story. He does it later on as well, but just in the other Torah portions, but just this part alone. So we have obviously, let's see, first one, sent to his brothers. And who sent him? His father. By father. Who gave him every authority there was, because who's in charge? Reuben was. He lost it when he slept with Bilhah. Who's in charge now? Has to the firstborn son. Well, Reuben's firstborn son of Leah. Who's the next wife? Rachel. So who's her firstborn son? No, Rachel, he's the youngest. Joseph. So it goes to the, he's by his father, but Joseph, Reuben lost his birthright as honor of the firstborn when he slept with his mother. So Joseph becomes the firstborn son, even though he's the youngest, one of the youngest. Father, so he's the younger son, the lowly one, but he is the one who's supposed to be in charge. Hence why Jacob treats him so well. Yeah, he's the one who's in charge to report back and explain. My father, so with authority. Funny, huh? God reuses symbols a lot. So Joseph became the firstborn. So Joseph is firstborn. Let me do that. Yes, when it discusses that, I believe it's in Deuteronomy? No. I forgot which book it is. It talks about, is it Deuteronomy? It talks about that Reuben was, they were recording the names, and they recorded it by birthright, and it starts listing Reuben's descendants, but he lost his birthright, his firstborn status, by sleeping with Bilhah, his father's wife. And so he was removed from firstborn status, no longer firstborn anymore. He is biologically, but not the right isn't his anymore. So Joseph is the firstborn, of course, obviously into his brothers, by his father's hand, with the authority to at least report on them what's going on. In his visit, who does he meet? when he's traveling from Hebron, this goes from Hebron to Shechem, who does he meet? Some guy. What's the guy tell him? His brothers are. So there was a guy there before him, some man, before. I won't tell his name, doesn't matter. I'll tell you who he's supposed to symbolize, though. Maybe for him, who sent him the correct way, right? For who gave him a proper path. Who prepares the way for the Messiah? John the Baptist, known as Elijah. So the man was there ahead of him, prepared the way, telling him, the way which you're after is not here, the way is over there. Prepare the way, tell him where to go. So this man, before Joseph, acts as Elijah and John the Baptist. That's a character. It's a character being played out in Joseph's story. Here's an interesting part, which I find interesting. You may not, but I do. Where does he direct him to? What town? No, he was already at Shechem. What town does he go to? He went from Hebron to Shechem. The man says, they're not in Shechem, they're in Dotham. In this picture up here, where's it? There it is, thank you. So Hebron's down here on a little map here. Here's the Salt Sea, this is Jerusalem. Hebron's down here. So he's in this area near Mamre where Isaac and where Jacob. Sorry, move this a little tiny way so you can see it. He says he's down here where he's hanging out. He believes the flocks have traveled up to Shechem, which is way up here. Now, mind you, like I said before, when you send your flocks out, it's not for a day. It's not for a week. It's for months. They come back during birthing time, because you need help, physical help when they produce lambs, or shearing time. Other than that, don't bother me with the flocks. Go make sure they're eating. They have to have a lot of areas. They're traveling all the time. He goes from Hebron to Shechem. He says, meets a man, they're not here. They're in Dotham up here, further north. Probably better grazing. The further north you go in Israel, the greener it becomes. But I want to bring your attention to the term Dotham.
Oops. I wrote an M, it's with the N.
What was that? Batman. That's Gotham. No, Batman doesn't live here. Dotham. Dotham. It comes to the root word meaning laws. That's the word. Dotham means it comes to the word laws. Not Torah, but laws in general. The idea of laws or a list of instructions. So I want to bring something to your attention. When Messiah shows up, and the way he's been prepared by John the Baptist, what is Messiah railing against while he's here?
They're fake laws.
They're laws. So these brothers went to the town of laws. And what does Messiah say? The laws you're going to are not right. They're not proper laws to do it. So in the symbolism of where the boys went to, where the sons traveled to, and they brought their sheep with them, little bells ring off, wait a minute, you brought your father's sheep to a town of new laws or additional laws. What did Messiah rail against? You're misleading the father's sheep and you're giving them laws as if they're laws of God or laws of men. It's a symbolism only, but it's using these words as teaching us examples. Yes, Jeff.
Well, then they should have gone to lose.
That's just wrong, but that's okay. So I said Dotham. Okay. So it's just symbolic, but it teaches examples. Because Dotham means create or to produce laws, and of course creating laws. And that's where they brought their father's sheep to them. And when they were there, what happened when they saw him? They conspired to kill him. What a Messiah when Messiah came to them. They conspired to kill him. And that was the idea of again, a symbolism, of course, as Messiah's life plays out in Jacob and Joseph's life, and vice versa. Now, this is what I want to bring your attention to with Reuben. Brilliant man, though he made really dumb mistakes. Okay, so Reuben. What was Reuben's solution? They're going to kill this boy, right? And that was the intent, to kill him off. They conspired to kill him. What's Reuben tried to do? He tried to save him, right? Keep him alive. To throw him in a pit. And he would, his intent is described, his intent is to, that he would deliver him to his father later. This is where Reuben's sleeping with his mom plays him out very well for our story. Reuben was firstborn, right? He slept with Bilhah, which made him no longer firstborn, but now the lowest among all of his brothers. The unimportant one, the lowly one, which you do not listen to or do not care for. That's Reuben's function or symbolism. He's the one who's trying to argue and save Joseph's life, to preserve him. He's the one who desired to restore him to his dad. In Messiah's day, when they conspired to kill him, who didn't want him killed? Who was at his side? Who was trying to... That's Peter. That's a man. Someone who has been brought low. Prostitutes, a lot of women. A lot of the ordinary people, the tax collectors, people who didn't like, who the society didn't like. Reuben was firstborn, right? In the eyes of his brothers, he is now the lowest one. In Messiah's day, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the various scribes, they are the in charge. In their eyes, where do the harlots, the prostitutes, and the tax collectors, where do they belong? They're low. The low one, Reuben, is desiring to preserve or save Joseph. The low one, the taxes and harlots, are trying to save and make Messiah king. That's their desire, to make him a king. So we see that Reuben is playing out the character, the role of the low people, the unimportant ones, in Messiah's day. Because they're trying to argue that he's God, he's the Son of God, he's the Messiah. They go through this whole process during Messiah's day. Reuben's playing that role. Because Reuben wants to bring him to his father. What do the people at Messiah's day want to do? Make him king. That's bringing him up to the status of in charge of everybody. So Reuben is doing, he's playing the role that everybody else, the commoners are trying to do at Messiah's day to fulfill that promise, fulfill that symbolism. Reuben's solution, of course, don't kill him. We'll preserve him, save him. We'll take care. Well, no, that was Judah was money. Reuben wasn't after the money. Reuben was trying to restore him to his power, restore him to where he belonged. So what happened then? So the brothers then strip him of his honor. They strip him of his tunic, his coat, right, and throw him in a pit. Did they strip Messiah of his honor too? Yes they did. So both Joseph and Messiah, both their honors get stripped by those who are in charge, those who are greater or in charge of them. And of course, they cast into a pit. The term pit we discussed this many times before. The pit with no water. It's an old well. It is a symbol of a grave. That is a symbolism. A pit with no water. When you dig a hole and you put somebody in it, what do we call it? A grave. We bury people and we cover up dirt over it and they rot. Does the hole have water in it? No. Not usually. That's called a well. This is a pit with no water in it. So they threw him in the grave. Yep. Water's life and there's no water in it. So the example of water being restoring life, there's no life in the grave. There's no, as David points out, there's no praise or worship of God in the grave. Doesn't exist. So the water being, having no water means this pit represents a grave. Now, is Joseph, is he dead? No. So he's alive going into the grave. Now, of course, Messiah dies and comes alive, come back out again. But Messiah is not truly, truly dead in the sense of a permanent death when he goes in the grave, is he? He's a temporary death. He knows it's 3 days. His body died, but his spirit's still alive. In Joseph's case, his honor gets stripped, but his body is not dead. Because obviously you can't kill Joseph, the story wouldn't work anymore. But symbolically, he's going into the grave alive, he'll come back out of it alive. Of course, he comes back out of it alive too. Let's see here. The boys sit to eat. What do they see when they're sitting down to eat after they cast in the pit? They see a caravan, and they're, what are they trading in? What's the caravan trading in? Spices. Spices, balsam, has a few of the lists that live, let us out. When the ladies go to Messiah's tomb, what do they have with them? Oil. Spices to oil the body up. So the Ishmaelites or Midianites are playing out having the spice caravan come, the supply caravan come while he's in the grave to, and of course they bring him out of the grave while he's there. So even the spice traders are part of the story too. Yeah, the spice traders, the Ishmaelites or Midianites, and then the Bible goes back and forth discussing whether Ishmaelites or Midianites, it doesn't matter. We'll discuss that later. The spice traders are Midianites, or Ishmael. Now, in the eyes of Israel, is Midian and Ishmael, are they honorable tribes? No, they're not. Israel concerned? No. God put them off. Now, they're relatives, but they are their own territory, their own way of life. They worship any god they can think of. That's their business. Women, there's a reason why God chose women to go down to find Messiah's body. Because women, they are permitted to touch a dead body and not have to worry about going into the temple. Because the temple doesn't permit somebody who touches a body to go in. You can't go in if you've touched a dead body. But women don't go in the temple at least 1 week a month anyway. Because they have their cycles to go through. You're not permitted to the temple anyway. Women not coming in, they are a, quote, lower or unelevated group on purpose. Because the men have to go in there all the time, stay clean all the time. That's the intent. The Midianite and Ishmaelites, even the fact that they are not Israelite, still also reflects in Messiah's story too, in the fact that women were the ones who went in, as opposed to men going in to go do it. Because mind you, it was during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's a holy time. Your goal is to stay holy. So the men were not about to touch a dead body, because you couldn't go to the temple for the whole week. Or not the whole week, but for each depending on which day you were going, for the day. So even the fact they were Midianites and Ishmaelites still is part of the story too, and Messiah and Joseph connection as far as between women being Midianite or Ishmaelite. Also on top of that, what are the Midianites killed for later? Harlotry for Baal Peor, which is a woman-based idea. As far as the women, harlot playing of the harlot to the people of Israel coming out of Israel, corrupting the men, of course, as we get the story of Cosby's death. And the Simeon. So even Midian is used again as a female context in that way too. So we still have an additional connection between the Midianites and the women at Messiah's day. Excuse me. Now, of course, he's sold for 20 pieces of silver, which obviously is also an additional connection to Messiah as well. Let's see, people returned. Okay, so now then, what happens? When Reuben comes back, he's gone. What did the women see when they came? I'm going to come back. What did the women see when they came to the grave? He was gone. So even the fact that Reuben came to preserve or restore the boy to Jacob, in Reuben's case, he comes and the grave is empty. Well, the grave being empty, I'll put this over here. The grave being empty, of course, also matches Messiah's grave being empty, because both the pit and the grave were both empty when the women showed up to take care of Messiah, as well as Reuben comes to take care of Jacob. And then what do the women do Messiah's day? What's the first reaction? They cry. What was Reuben's first reaction?
Cry.
He cries. What are we going to do? And what does Reuben say? Where is the boy? He's gone. Well, the women say, where's the body? He's gone. They stole him away, return him, bring him back to me. So even the act of stealing, because that's what Judah did, they wound up taking the body and they sold him. They did not have the right to sell their brother, did they? No. You had to kidnap him, hence body stolen at Messiah's day. The women said, they take the body, where did it go? They take the boy, where did it go? They kidnapped him. So the women thought the Messiah was kidnapped, or taken, or body was taken. Taken away, and of course, they sold him unjustly. He's not their property to sell. Of course, Reuben was concerned. What was Reuben's response? Where will I go? What do I do now? Why not? Right, he's not important. He still gets blamed for it. Who's going to blame him? Jacob is going to blame him. His dad's going to blame him. Jacob's still going to blame Reuben. Reuben lost his firstborn right as a firstborn status. But that doesn't make him not the oldest son. And if Reuben had successfully restored Joseph to his father, what would that have done in his father's eyes toward Reuben? It would have helped. It would have helped elevate Reuben back up to, okay, you are worth something. You're not a destitute, worthless son of mine. You have tried to redeem yourself. What's Reuben doing now? Where will I go? I will not be redeemed. I have nowhere to go. I have no way of redeeming my image in my father's eyes. Is it Messiah's job to redeem us? And what does that redemption mean? Yeah, but to bring us up into our father's eyes, to lift us up to him, and he receive us, that's the idea of redemption. So Reuben's pointing out that now that the boy's gone,
I can't be
elevated back up in my father's eyes, which of course is consistent with the symbolism of Messiah and the story of the women when they were upset. Not sure what to do, where to go. And also consistent with what will I do now? When Messiah died, what did his disciples go do? Took off. Most of them took off. Some went back to fishing. What are they going to do now? They were lost. And so they came back from the dead, and they said, wait a minute, what? And then they was drawn back in after they had seen him and seen his body. They literally were lost, so to speak. The same symbols and the same storyline. Let's see here. We'll go to...
Messiah had to come after
them. Yeah, yes. Messiah had to come. Exactly. Had to go out and get them. They, in order to conceal the dead body, what did they do? Or the dead body. Conceal the missing boy. What was their solution?
They killed an animal.
Killed what kind of animal? A goat. What is Messiah's job? Symbolically, he is our sin offering. That's what it says. If we don't have him, none of us have a sin offering. Therefore, the book of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy is going to kill us all. Because, as God said, if you don't have a sin offering, he's not going to look at you or look at me. He's going to look at the sin that's in front of you. He says, I don't need that, and wash it away, in which case you get washed away too. You're gone. You need a sin offering to say, just wash the sin away and keep the person there. You need the sin offering. What is a goat throughout your entire Torah? It is a sin offering. It's used over and over and over again. Every holy day, every event, there is one offering. It's always the sin offering. So what they use the sin offering to pour the sin's offering blood all over the boy's coat and say, look! Again, another symbol, a matching Messiah's symbols, Messiah's match as far as he is our sin offering. He is the goat. He is that example. We also use the goat in the Hebrews talks us again in the form of atonement. Related for Passover, there's two different sin addresses. One addresses sin of, I have no clue I sinned. And then one addresses sin as, I know full well I sinned. And oops, there's a difference of which one addresses for what. And the boys know full well they're sinning. They know full well they kidnapped a boy. They sold him. They're lying to their father. They're pretending he's dead in the process, which of course brings shame. Then they all have to conspire together. Don't tell anybody. Don't let it get out. They're conspiring to do it all. It's a very elaborate process of death. Yes.
But in the Torah, if you're a kidnapper, that's a death penalty. That's a penalty too.
Yeah, it's all a death penalty. So all of their sins, all combined together, are then culminated in, what do? They offer a sin offering. God, forgive me my sins. Which is what you want. But it is. It's symbolic, of course. They use the blood to cover up the sins, which is the exact symbol. That's what it is. It matches Messiah. They use the goat's blood to cover the sins. That's Messiah's blood covers your sins. It's all symbolic. But that's the nature of how this story in Joseph is being played out. It's done there on purpose. And of course, the father then identifies the item, the goat, the sin offering, the blood of the goat, and the garment. And what does the father do? He laments into mourning. When Messiah died, what did God do? What happened? When the stories tell us in the gospel instructions, Messiah is dead. Messiah dies. He dies. Okay, he's dead. Hanging out there, dead. What happens? Yeah, the sun turns black.
Yeah.
Earthquake happens. There's lots of things coming down from heaven. Is God happy or is God unhappy? He'd be unhappy. Now, was it proper? It had to happen. Yes, of course. He's still not happy about it. He doesn't want someone dead. He doesn't want the death of the righteous person or the unrighteous. He doesn't want the death of anybody. He's lamenting. He's sorrowful. He's upset. Again, Jacob, of course, matches out the same symbols that the Messiah does, or God does in this case, because Jacob's playing the role of God in this story. All right. Then this Jacob, of course, Joseph, is sold. Let me reset it. Is sold to where? Where does he end up? Where does he finally end up? Egypt. Throughout your Torah, what is Egypt symbolic of? Sin. What else is it symbolic of? Bondage. Yeah. And the world. These are all various symbols or examples used of Egypt and what how it's used throughout the Torah, throughout the Tanakh in general. So Messiah is sold and he goes off into this area. What does he become when he's there? In charge of... Yeah, God blesses him. He eventually becomes in charge of the world. He eventually dominates as far as Egypt, he dominates all of Egypt eventually. We learn as he becomes second only to Pharaoh. Everything he does, he's second only to the one who actually gave him the authority to begin with. He's always second in charge. So he wants to be in all the world. While he's there, when he's there, and becomes in charge of the world, which we'll learn in the next Torah portion, he puts the entire world where? In bondage. To whom? Him and Pharaoh. Do you want to be in bondage to God? Yeah. That's a good thing. You want to be bondage to God. So even in the next Torah portion, when we discuss Joseph, when he goes through his life, he's still playing out Messiah's role. He's now in charge of the world, second only to Pharaoh, also as a king or God, and everyone is in bondage to him or to Pharaoh as his owner, and he's now the owner.
But also,
yes. Joseph still.
What was the name of the boy?
Jacob. Rachel married Jacob. Oh, that's right. I'll come back to you. So, in this whole story, we the point is that if the chapter 37 in particular, I want you to remember, and also 38, 39 and 42, that it is your reading Messiah's life and a viewpoint of his view and how he's what he's experiencing. So as you would feel or see or understand Messiah's life, feel and understand what Joseph's going through. And that will give you an understanding deeper what Messiah was going through. Not through physical, but so much as what his emotional mental state was. Was it easy for Joseph? Did he think it was right and just? No, not at all. But he did it anyway, and was he successful? Yes. Wherever God put him, or what it was, he successfully did it anyway. He persevered. He was diligent in his service. Let's jump to, let's move past Joseph a little bit and jump into to Judah a little bit and Tamar. We won't spend too much time here in this section, but there's certain details which I think it's valuable to know.
38.
38. I'm going to erase some of this because I need more board space. Yeah. And now we have an intermission, so to speak, of the story of Joseph. And we jump to the story of Judah, which everybody says, why on earth is the story of Judah right in the middle of this seemingly perfect continuing story of Joseph's history? I won't be testing that today. No. The chiastic structure is there, but I talked about last time. I changed what I talk about each time, so I won't discuss the chiastic structure. But yes, if you did look through it, Joseph and Judah's chiastic structure are built so that they are designed to parallel each other. We won't discuss that today, though. It's in previous lessons. Today I'm talking about specifically regarding Judah, one of the things he's understanding or seeing. Because mind you, we just went through what Joseph was experiencing and how his brothers and how that related to Messiah. Well, now, I also mentioned when I started out, that the character of Joseph and the character of Judah represents their respective families. and how they view themselves and can carry themselves throughout the following generations through many, many, many years, through multiple thousands of years. In Judah's case, which is why this is important for us to remember and how it's written here, and why it's written here, my opinion, why it's written here. Yes, they're all brothers, but Judah's from Leah, a different mom. So Judah, he separates himself at this time. So the time which Joseph is sold and goes off the caravan, Judah now separates himself from his other brothers. So he separates. About the same time, probably, I imagine, within a few weeks or months of each other. Time. Judah has three sons initially, and he winds up having two additional sons, and two of his oldest sons are old enough to get married, so that's a period of time lapse, and they die all before Joseph is revealed as far as what happened to who he is in Egypt, and they all go down to Egypt. And Joseph's in Egypt for about, 20 years, something like that. So it's all about a 20-year span, so everything is occurring. So all the story of Joseph all the way until Jacob comes down, and the story of Judah getting married and having a bunch of kids, all the same 20-year spans. And the two oldest boys have to be old enough to be married, if that's of a certain age. And the third boy also has to be approaching that age too, because Tamar is pointing out, hey, he's old enough. So again, even all three sons, there's a certain amount of time. You can't marry a 4-year-old off, but you can marry somebody in their late teens or their 20s. So it's about the same time period both these are happening. Judah separates himself. Why do you think Judah separated himself from his brothers? Now put yourself in Judah's position for a minute. Who sold him? Who sold Jacob? Or Joseph, They did. Whose idea was it? It was his idea. Judah's idea to sell him. And did the brothers agree to follow his lead?
Yes.
Yes, so they all sold him. What did Judah then do by doing this act and the brothers agreeing with him? He became the new firstborn. The new one in charge, because they all agreed to follow him. Reuben's already lost his status. Joseph's now gone. He's out of the way. So it could go to any one of the other boys. In this case, Judah dominates and becomes, I will be the one in charge. But that comes with certain responsibilities. What happens when you are responsible?
You have to
take care of everything, but when things go wrong, who is at fault? You are. So when Judah separated himself, in the process of selling Joseph, he then took on the responsibility of what Joseph would have been, the firstborn, after Reuben, of course, had lost his. So Judah's taken on, and all of his brothers, at least the ones that were there at the time, agreed to it, agreeing to give Judah and defer to him. It was his idea. They agreed, yeah, it's a great idea. Let's go. Let's follow you and follow along with it. So who's now responsible? Yeah? Judah. Judah's responsible. Now, put yourself in Judah's position. Your dad is mourning every day and every night, thinking his son's dead. And you know the truth.
Yeah.
How awful does that make you feel?
You feel like
you don't want to, would you want to keep seeing him every morning saying, good morning, Dad? No. What would you do?
I'd go away.
You're humiliated. It's called shame. So Judah's problem, he has shame. And what do you do when you have shame? The idea, the term shame, implies I wish to be concealed. I don't want you to see me ashamed of something. You want to conceal it. Well, in Judah's case, the concealing process is I will then just be not seen. I will leave. I will take off and attach myself to my friends of Canaan and various other places he winds up going. Of course, gets married later on. So he separates himself because he's shamed for what he just did. You know, he preserved Joseph's life, but not the way Reuben would have done it. Yeah, he doesn't know for sure. At the time when he sold him, he assumed he was alive. But what was Reuben's solution to save his life?
Bring him back.
What was Judah's solution? Get rid of him. Kill him, get rid of him. He's going to sell him eventually. They wanted to kill him. Both preserved his life eventually, but one was trying to do it in an honorable fashion, the other was trying to do it in a very dishonorable fashion. And he is now shamed, knowing that he's conspired to lie to his father about this son that's now missing. So yes, it makes sense he wants to separate himself because he's miserable. He's full of shame now. He's responsible. He knows he's responsible. When Messiah was sitting there and he was already arrested, and the Roman pilot thing came out. Pilate comes out and says, "I find no fault in him." What were the crowd saying? "Crucify him. May his guilt be upon us and our descendants." What were they doing? Now, mind you, this is dominated by Judah. They cursed themselves. Again, the shame. You are taking the responsibility that it's our fault. We'll accept it and move forward. And Judah, it was his fault. He didn't do it the way Reuben was going to do it. In his own way. Of course, he's responsible, hence the shame that comes with that. The responsibility. It's a big responsibility. He took it lightly. And then, he has three boys. Judah does. He has three sons then. Onan, and Shelah. No. Is evil, Onan's bad, Shelah lives, but for other reasons. Awake. Or appear to open up, look and see, may God see you. Onan, strong or your strength. That's the name. And Shelah, I wrote that down. Shelah was your request or your petition. And where was Shelah born in? What town? Chazeb, which means failed. Also used as false. So awake, your strength. Awaken your strength. Your request has failed. That's what that was who his son. Those four names put together. It's a symbol. It's a message. Judah, open your eyes. Well, Judah gave him this name. His wife gave him that name, and Judah named this one. And the town he was born in, which is the town he was born in. So it's a sequence of just semi-random events. Not planning it to look like it was bad, but turns out it was a prophecy against him himself, his own sons. Behold, the strength that your request, but hold your strength or open your eyes, become stronger, become aware. Your request is failed. You failed. You're false. I'm not permitting it. I'm denying it. That's the symbol. What the symbolism putting these four names together. And of course, it tells Judah, and what does he get? His sons die. What does Judah receive? He has these three boys, and God starts whacking them off. Judah, you failed. Judah, you failed. Now Judah's afraid, the last one, he says, okay, don't marry him off. What difference does it make? You failed too. No, Shelah becomes, he does not die. Shelah becomes the minor tribe of Judah, the insignificant one. He becomes unimportant. The other two sons that he has, Zerah and Perez, become the dominant players. And Shelah becomes an almost insignificant, unrecorded person. He's recorded again. He has a few children, but it's as if he is lost inside the tribe of Judah. Yes, Anne.
Doesn't it say later, though, that Judah, the scepter, will never leave you?
Right.
So the failure becomes success. And
you will succeed. Eventually you succeed. Judah, after he goes through all this process, what does he do to succeed? What was that? He does offer taking his place, right? He does. He changes his character, doesn't he? He changes his character. He realizes, wait a minute, there's a better way. Judah's character changes. And we get a glimpse of that through Tamar. He acknowledges Tamar's righteousness. So Tamar is, of course, the wife of these two, and eventually the concubine, I guess you call her. What you call her, of Judah. She's used by him. Yes.
After
sin, basically, then Tamar takes his identity from him.
Yeah. Strips him of it. Yep.
But when he acknowledges her righteousness, everything is given back to him.
Yep. Which is exactly where I'm going right now. Tamar's story, she is a Canaanite probably. It doesn't even matter what she is or isn't. The point is this. Through her marriage to Ur and Onan, God reveals to Judah, these boys are evil. Don't like him? Get rid of him. I won't tolerate this evilness coming from you, Judah, and I won't let it continue on. God wipes out these men. And of course, Shelah's supposed to the next one. And Tamar's story, she of course recognizes, okay, she's, I don't know how old she was. I'm guessing she wasn't terribly old, else let's go through a lot, pretty young to begin with. She goes through this whole story, and she realizes, wait a minute, Shelah's old enough. I'm supposed to be his wife, of course. He's not giving Shelah, her to Shelah as his wife. And she then prostitutes herself. We discussed this earlier regarding the multiple gods and what Judah would have naturally thought. No big deal. Well, just a various harlotry commonly done. But the process, what she has correctly pointed out was, what did Tamar use? She took his staff, his sash or identifying banner, what identified who he was, or either garment, whatever you call it, a seal, and identifying, basically an identifying garment. Everybody knows what it is. She stripped him of his identity. Now, symbolically, when you strip someone of their identity, what did you do? You stripped them of their authority. Yes.
These are all things that a king would have.
Yes, they are. These are all items that a king would have, each one of these items. That's how you identify a royal family. They identify through a garment, a banner, whatever it is, with the match of their garment, their staff or their scepter, as well as their seal. You seal a message that comes from me as a king. You're absolutely correct. He carries himself like a king would carry himself, which makes sense. But she strips him of all of it. It does save her life, but in the process, his identity is then lost. And then when she comes out, I'm pregnant, he says, kill her, crucify, burn her up, she's a bad person, aha, I'm now justified. Yeah, but then when those items are restored, so his identity comes back, when he receives his identity again, I before E. Oh, so there's, oh, I hate that. Oh, whatever. Okay. He receives his identity. He receives his identity again. When he receives it back, he recognizes, I was at fault. I was wrong. I was the corrupt one. I did what was evil. You are right. Yes.
This just shows to Goya that when you point a finger, there's three pointing back.
There are. This symbolism that we're seeing here in this storyline of Tamar, in her actions, through her, I used her loosely, her sins, she redeemed Judah. It's quite interesting. Through her sin, Judah got redeemed. What was it before? Humiliated and ashamed. After this process, he gets redeemed. And what does he get out of it? Two sons, Zerah and Perez. Oops, P. That's probably true. You're right. He may have had even a harder time accepting that. If he had killed her, then obviously the babies would also have been dead, because she was pregnant, clearly. He would have killed, obviously, more people. This storyline, which is really important to the entire Torah and Messiah's life, is all centered around this boy. Peretz.
Right hand of God!
He is the breach. He's the one who came at second born. He breaks through. He is the ancestor of King David. He's the ancestor of all the royal families. He's the ancestor of Messiah himself. Through him, Judah is redeemed. It's through his line. And that's, again, the whole symbol behind Zerah and Perez is that, wait a minute, Zerah's one came forth first, and God says, no, pull it back. I'm choosing this one to burst forth through to redeem Judah. Yes.
How did he get that Latino name?
How do you get the Latino name? Good question. I don't know. Perez in Hebrew means to burst forth or to be strong one or to breach, to break through. Like you broke through a wall. You breached the wall. It's the Hebrew word for it. I'm not sure how it's spelled in the Hebrew lettering. I'd have to look it up myself. It's probably in here somewhere. But I'm going to search through it now. But that it means a breakthrough, to burst, to break something out. So in this process of receiving his identity back, he now is Messiah, will come through. Through Perez. Does that make sense? So this whole story is the falling down or bringing down low of some of the sons, some of the brothers, and the raising up of Judah, but then the humiliation that Judah now brought upon himself, and the process which he goes through redemption, how he gets back out again, to recognize he was wrong and the other, in this case Tamar, was right. Though she sinned too, not the same kind of sin. His sin what caused her to sin. That makes sense? Now, that says she is not responsible for her sins. Yes, she is. The point is that if he followed suit and did correctly, his story would not have happened. Yeah, it is. And had he followed suit with Joseph, his shame wouldn't have happened. Had he followed Reuben's lead and said, yes, restore him to his father, his shame wouldn't have happened either. He has to recognize his own character flaws and find out, I have humiliated myself in these ways. And then I need to be redeemed. And we find out he's redeemed when he then tries to say no to Joseph. You will not take Benjamin. Take me instead. To offer himself in the place of someone else. Right? That's an important character. It showed Joseph. Right. It did. They finally grew up. It showed Joseph that Judah is... Joseph wasn't dumb. He knew Judah was selling him. He wasn't an idiot. He's a 17-year-old boy. He could hear the words, but they recognize that Judah changes. And through this process, why the story is right in the middle of Joseph's story, is that during the time Joseph was going through his trials, Judah is learning from God what is right and changing by the end of it. Does that make sense? By the time Joseph, they've all come back. They've all responded and repaired themselves in their standing. I'm not going to go through the story of the cupbearer and such unless you really need to. I'm out of time. Any thoughts or questions?
I don't have enough time.
It's always time. Any thoughts or questions?
No, that was
yes?
That it was part of Canaanite culture, that if the father was not willing to give his sons in Levirate marriages, that he was actually responsible to produce the child.
That is a Canaanite, you're right, that is a Canaanite philosophy. I read that a couple weeks ago. That would imply that she didn't cause a sin. However, he was still her father-in-law. She was supposed to follow instructions. But it's. I won't go into the details beyond that. Before I close out, just there's one thing I want to point out to you, which I should have mentioned, which I meant to before. Regarding when Joseph does go through his experiences in Egypt and comes out of the prison, and let's come out, but he's in the prison, sorry, with the cupbearer and the baker. The story doesn't tell us why or what Pharaoh was upset about with these two men, which they got thrown in there. But it does imply that obviously one of them committed some sin against Pharaoh or they got mad at them. Mind you, at this time in history, a sin can be something very, very small. Very, very small. For example, you have a servant. You walk around and you accidentally dropped and broke a dish. My wife loved that dish. Go hang him. It's not uncommon. It's easy to do because the laws are not the same as they are now. We are run by rules of law. They're run by rules of what the king felt like. There's a difference. So the cupbearer and the baker could have done something very, very, very minor, insignificant, and still lose their lives. Even if they could have been just doing their job and made anything could have happened. It's very common. So when we read this story, keep in mind the characters that Joseph is going to interact with are not honorable characters. They are been raised and taught dishonor or disrespect because they are in charge. Whatever they say happens and goes and does. It doesn't matter what difference it is. And that's how it works. It's not uncommon. So when we go through the story, remember that the experience that Judah went through with Tamar and the Canaanites that he lived in his day is not quite the same type of people that the Egyptians are. Egyptians are different. They have different philosophies, different laws, different lifestyles. But they are still very powerful. Both groups are very powerful. The Canaanites' claim to fame is money. The Canaanites were notorious traders. They trade their merchants. That's what Canaanites did. That was their livelihood. Egypt's claim to fame was war. That's what they did. That was their livelihood. They're very good at their respective businesses. The Canaanites were the jobs of all the trade caravans coming through in and out, and they would charge fee, obviously. And so when we deal with Judah and dealing with Tamar and the type of culture she was raised with and the type of Judah's wife's culture was raised with, they're raised with money, money, more money. That's what their life is. Egypt's life is war, war, and more war. That's what their life is. So Joseph's experience is going to be very different than Judah's experience. Hence, possessions are important to Tamar because they mean something, because it's things, versus Joseph, people are important. They mean something. That's what he was raised with. People matter. Things don't. It's a different way of looking at stuff and understanding the mentality of these men. Yes, Carrie.
One thing that I found interesting coming up to the story of Tamar and Judah is that we've actually, for the last several weeks, we've actually read through several stories where somebody did the same nature of what Tamar did.
Yeah.
And our normal inclination is not to sentence them to death when we read about it. You know, we read about Jacob, you know, usurping Esau, and we say, well, but God said that was the promise.
To give sympathy to it.
We've got this sympathy for these characters, and even Abraham with Ishmael and Isaac, you know, where he tried to speed up God's process, and, you know, oh, they're just trying to fulfill God's promise. And then you get to Tamar, and you go, whoa.
Yeah. That crossed too far.
Not okay. But interestingly enough, all of those characters, God came back to them and said, you guys are trying to go too fast. This is your consequence. But with Tamar, she actually got completely left off. Mm-hmm. You know, God did not.
No harm.
In fact, actually, he blessed her action. And so I thought that was really interesting is that, you know, we go through this series and, you know, and then you get here and you go, oh, that was just so wrong. And God's like, that's the one that I'm going to say, you know what? You're okay.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
So but I also kind of thought, it's, you know, even though God didn't necessarily sentence some terrible judgment on the previous ones either, it was kind of more natural consequences.
They still had consequences
to their decisions. Yep. So I think, you know, for me, there was kind of a picture in there for us as humans to not be pointing fingers so easily.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, because we don't know. And the other thing I was thinking too, specifically with Tamar and Judah, is that, you know, in the Torah, God says don't provide an atmosphere where prostitutes are needed.
Right.
His command is at the men.
Yes.
It's not at the women.
Right.
And Judah, by his actions, put that need for her to even do that. So her righteousness really was better than his.
Yes, it was. That's a great way of putting it. When you look at stories, and all of the stories are written this way, that, yeah, there is a sin, a transgression, whatever it is, and there's a sequence of how a person is redeemed. When it comes to, you're absolutely correct, Tamar is in that category. There's a couple other ladies and men who are also in the same category. There's a reason why the Haftorah portion of this is Book of Amos, or parts of Book of Amos. We went through Amos a long time ago. But the main principle of Amos was, it's how you are treating other people that God is angry at. Now, we look at today and say, oh, well, what's God mad at our country for? He's mad at abortion. He's mad at, you know, money, anything, lots of you, we have a lot of things that God's all mad about. But what does God say he's mad at? Well, according to all the prophets, he's mad at how you treat someone else. That's what he's mad at. It's a treating of other people. That's what he gets angry, gets upset with. And all these characters, when they treat someone else poorly, God gets mad. When they don't treat someone else poorly, he says, okay, it's okay. I'm not as upset as I would be had you done poorly. It's very interesting that God seems to rail against very heavily through all the prophets of how you are treating other people. It really matters. How did Judah treat Tamar? Well, up until she got pregnant, not so great. He didn't treat her properly. He didn't treat her correct the way she should be treated as a true wife. And how to treat Joseph? Again, not so great. How you treat people, God really cares. Whether or not we claim, oh, well, there's umpteen million babies killed every year from abortion. Yeah, that's true. Is that evil? Yes, it is. God condemns offering your children to Moloch, which is what abortion is offering your children to Moloch. You're offering it up to gain a better life. Well, he's upset with that completely. Is that what he rails against most of the time? No. What is he railing against most of the time? How you treat other people. That's what he rails against. And when we learn from our patriarchs, how they treat other people, in a good way, mimic that, and we do well. It's important. And he forgives people when they've treated those well. A Canaanite, the command, the Torah command specifically is later on. But up to this point in the sons' lives, because Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac's mom, Rebecca, was not going to allow him to have a Canaanite or anybody else kind of wife. So they wanted one from their family. And like the same thing happens with Jacob, that Rebecca is upset, says, don't let him marry a Canaanite instead of the family. It's not a Torah command yet. The law to not do so isn't part of it. It's the preference of the wives, the mothers of these boys. Don't do what these women do. Because mind you, I mentioned earlier when we started out, the four gods, that's just four of them. What did they do? Well, they would harlot themselves out. They would offer their kids to gods. They would, I didn't just go to the practice of worshiping Adon, but Adon was the beating of oneself, mourning his death every year for a week before you kill the child to Molech. It's a long process because they did things every single year, every cycle. All the Canaanites participated because that was their gods. That's how they did things. Well, you wouldn't want that in your family. And that was a big deal. Now, later on, we learned that God says, don't you ever marry a Canaanite. They are abhorrent in their practices. Well, yeah, they offer the kids a Molech. How more abhorrent do you get? That's pretty bad. But yeah, so the command for Judah wasn't given yet, but the implication from his parents and his grandparents and great-grandparents was, that's not a good thing. But these boys all had to marry someone. I mean, Jacob had one daughter that we know of, and she can't marry her brothers. They have to find wives somewhere, and so if you choose amongst your neighbors. Any questions or comments? We'll close the prayer then, okay? Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat, a day of rest, a day of learning and study and trust and worship of you. Father, thank you for your love and care of all of us. We ask you to bless us this day, Father, and bless the food that we eat, that we share and share our stories and our love and our blessings from you to encourage one another. Please, Father, grant us peace, good health, and strength, that we will always strive to follow you wherever you lead, whether it be in a pit or whether it be in the world. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.